Thank you for listening to Season 3 of the Creative Sober Podcast. I am your host and sober creative, Missing May. Our episodes are a collection of interviews with sober creatives who inspire and continue to create sober. We are 2 episodes away from wrapping up Season 3. These past few months have been personally an incredible journey of meeting other sober creatives in our community who are openly sharing their process of becoming alcohol-free and thriving because of it. If there is an episode that impacted you in any way, we would love to hear about it. Hop over to our Instagram page at The Creative Sober and connect with other sober creatives online. In episode 11, I meet with none other than Tommy Sunshine. His name was established throughout the American rave scene during the 90s and helped set the stage for the EDM boom of the 2010s. 29 years as a DJ and 35 years as a clubber gives Sunshine his unique perspective on the business and informs his present rave revival sound. Tommy shares wisdom with us about his journey in recovery, being sober for 16 years, his impact as an activist, and how everything he is passionate about, whether elevating the energy in the room, on the DJ decks, or teaching at NYU, leads to we the people in conscious unity. Get ready for a ride during this conversation and hang tight towards the end to hear his collab with Breakthrough on track Untouchable featuring Kaislyn Victoria. Here's my conversation with Tommy. Tommy Sunshine, welcome to the podcast. How's it going?
It is going good. I mean, the best it can be. We're living in a topsy-turvy time, but here we are.
Agreed. And, you know, thank you so much for coming on and sharing in a topic and a conversation around what we can do to, you know, try and level and stay balanced in our life. And so the topic is going to be around being a sober creative, which you are very familiar with. Backstory on you, 16 years sober. Could you share with our listeners, you know, what your creative background and your profession is?
For the people who don't know who I am, I'm a DJ and a producer. I'm an activist. I teach at NYU. There's a whole lot of cultural anthropologists. There's a long list of things that I suppose that I do. I've been in dance music culture for more than half my life. I've been DJing for 30 years this year. Mm-hmm. And just lover of music and lover of life.
That's amazing. Almost 30 years. And I mean, you have quite a resume on the work that you've put out there. And the fact that you've been able to see electronic music and house music in general evolve over time, I'm curious, what's your take on what that looks like in the evolution of electronic music?
I think one of the biggest things, which gets often overlooked, electronic music and specifically dance music, mm-hmm. when it started, it was subversive. It was countercultural. It was subculture. And it was against the law. It was a drug culture.
Right.
It's still a drug culture, but the rest of it, I'm not so sure. You know what I mean? Like, it has definitely turned into something that is very corporate. The decisions are being made about who to book, not from a musical perspective, it's from a finance perspective. Mm-hmm. And these kinds of things never came into play when we started doing this, because there wasn't a music business. There was nothing big enough to warrant people on Wall Street getting their hands dirty in what we were doing. I think people saw dollar signs and they saw potential, and they came in and changed a lot of things. And I think that in order for electronic music to get to the meteoric heights that it's gotten to, they had to sacrifice the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, there is still a rave scene. The kids here in Brooklyn are having gabber parties underneath the train tracks, and they're dancing to this super, super fast, very, very heavy electronic music that's a reflection of the world that we're living in right now.
Oh, wow. Yes, that's an interesting perspective there. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, and to be fair, I mean, in the 90s, when I got into this, it was the same thing. Like, it was, you know, we were mirroring what was going on in society. You know, we didn't want anything to do with all of the mainstream trends. We were in the subculture. And, you know, there was a saying that always got thrown around looking back at the 90s. And it was like all the Midwest rave kids were all the kids that ate lunch by themselves.
Yes.
That kid from every school, and we all like converged into the rave scene. So all the proper weirdos kind of all descended onto electronic music. And that's where we found our home.
That is amazing. I am Gen X myself and understand the rave culture and grew up in Hawaii. And a lot of the raves were warehouses just off the beaten path, and you waited for a call or you knew somebody who knew somebody and you would find the party. It's where you felt like you belonged, and the judgment scene wasn't there to be had. It was just a place of unity and being in one, expressing and feeling the music. It was about the music, but a lot of that also in that culture was about drugs.
You know, one of the things that was so stitched in to the original rave scene was that there was an element of danger, like a legitimate element of danger. You didn't know if cops were going to shut the party down. You didn't know if you were going to get arrested. And we were all partaking in all kinds of illegal drug use. Like, we all could have gone to jail for years and years and years. Just, you know, I mean, because it was a different time. What I think gets a little lost on all of this is buying a ticket pre-sale with a service charge from a ticketing service, and then showing up to a festival that is laden with security and, you know, they're working alongside the cops and everything else. Like, things have changed and they need to. But I'm just saying that, like, the potential for danger in those situations is minimal at best.
Right. It's controlled.
It's a controlled environment.
Right.
You know, we were in the exact opposite of that. We were dancing on dance floors, and, you know, at 2 a.m, we'd be like, oh, that was really cool. Like, when the promoter dropped that snow from the ceiling, and it was like, oh no, that was asbestos. Like, being rattled out of the ceiling by the base cabinets. Like, I mean, we could all have mesothelioma by now. Right. From the amount of, like, dangerous environments we were in. But that's what made it so attractive.
Like, that's true.
We wanted to do these things, you know, kind of naughty and kind of dangerous. And it was like, that was the allure. And, you know, now it's become a very different thing.
Well, there is a lot of exposure. I mean, social media in general and just the internet and how things are just brought out to the surface, like, quickly. There's no mystery about anything. And so it creates this environment where all eyes on me. What do I look like? What am I doing? Am I doing this right or wrong? There's a different chatter that's happening in folks' mind when they're supposed to be in this environment, connecting to the music and having fun and being free. So the environments have changed. Yes, absolutely.
And also, I mean, and this is where it kind of comes full circle, you know, into addiction is like, you know, in the 90s, people didn't have DJ careers. They didn't go on world tours. They weren't on airplanes all the time. Like, I mean, people traveled sometimes. That was, like, normal, but it wasn't to the degree that things are now. So you have an industry that's responsible for a DJ AM situation. You have an industry that's responsible for an Avicii situation.
Right.
In the 90s, if somebody kind of slipped up or got a little crazy, we were there to, like, push the broom and clean it up. And right. we would get involved. We'd get our hands dirty and we'd sort it out. And we'd right. make sure that they landed on their feet and that they went home okay. But when you subtract the culture,
right.
from what you get is you get people with private drug problems. And you have, like, you know, there are people touring, their own tour managers who travel with them every day don't even know of those shenanigans. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If I can give the modern kind of wing of this any proper critique, it's that if you were going to put a teenager on the road to play 200 plus dates a year, and mm-hmm. that person was making literally millions of dollars, wouldn't you hire somebody to travel with that kid? Mm-hmm. Like, who is some sort of doctor that could monitor their diet, could monitor their exercise, could monitor their intake of drugs and alcohol, and, you know, make sure that they don't get swept up into the abyss. Yeah. And there's none of that.
Wow. Okay. So you're not seeing any of that type of support.
There is next to no harm reduction.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Like, you know, I mean, and you watch the Avicii documentary and, you know, his manager talks about, you know, how he's going to tour himself to death. Mm-hmm. He says it in plain English. It's terrifying. You know, like, I mean, it's like they were aware of the problems.
Right. I mean, that's why I asked, because you do have folks talking about it and they're aware of the situation happening and the fact that there isn't a safety net or a team around this person is just mind-boggling. How do you navigate those environments, Tommy?
I think it's twofold. I would rather be around a room full of people on drugs than in a bar any day, because people on drugs don't fight. There's no aggression. William S. Burroughs, who, you know, was a very famous drug addict, you know, he has a very famous quote that he said, "The only substance that I ever did anything that I regretted on was alcohol."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would have to agree with that.
I agree with that. Yes.
That's very solid, sage advice. But, you know, when I see kids having a good time and they're on drugs and they're having fun, who am I to, like, shake a finger at them? You know what I mean? Like, it's not hard mm-hmm. for me to navigate, because I think that there's a point where the drugs stop working. I think that you have to look at this in a way, and I think you have to be real about the fact that, you know, there are lessons to be learned.
Mm-hmm.
Drugs. I mean, I can't say I look back in complete regret of all of the experiences that I had, but there was definitely a learning curve right. where, like, I was having fun and learning things and enjoying myself. And then all of a sudden that turned into something very different.
Right.
And it became a coping mechanism. It became maintenance. It became self-medicating. It became a lot of different things. And it was no longer fun. It was essential.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very dangerous. Like, when something is no longer helping you and it's no longer serving you in your life, that's a pretty solid red flag that there's a problem. And my personal situation with sobriety was, I saw what was about to happen with this music in 2005. I knew that something was going to change. I could see, you know, the Ed Banger blog house, like, fidget scene with Switch and Crookers and the early Dutch house stuff and you know, Justice and all of that was, like, coming right. together. And there was this really amazing scene. And I was like, okay, I have a choice. I can either go 150 miles an hour with a brick on the gas pedal into this and crash and burn, mm-hmm. or I can get my shit together and actually carve out a legacy for myself and have a career in this. And I'm very lucky that my love for music somehow made me have a realization that I needed to fix my life. My disease is heavy duty. Like I am a drug addict. I am an alcoholic. I am sober and I am in recovery, mm-hmm. but I will be those things for the rest of my life. And I have to monitor that all the time. And I have to make sure that I'm not, you know, doing other things to excess, whether it's the internet or overeating or, you know, like all of the other things that mm-hmm. you can get tangled up in, which are exactly the same thing. I knew I wanted to get sober. And the year before I quit drugs and alcohol, I quit drinking coffee and I quit smoking because I didn't want to be one of those sober people that had a Starbucks cup in one hand and a Marlboro Red in the other.
Right, yes.
I know lots of sober people that are like that. And I'm unsure that's sober. You know what I mean? Because you've just swapped out stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, like now that's your crutch. You haven't addressed the reason why you got to that place in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it goes deeper. It goes deeper with addiction and recovery. And, you know, once you get past that, okay, what's the real stuff that's going on?
You know, everything in the modern perspective, you know, we talk about a lot of things now being on the spectrum, you know, with mental health, gender, all of these other things. But, you know, my God, addiction is a spectrum. And it's so different for every single mm-hmm. person. I mean, every person I've ever known that, you know, and I've lost lots of friends. You know, I've seen 4 solid decades of people fall because of this, whether it was the actual addiction that caught up with them physically, or it drove them to take their own life, yeah. or, you know, all of the different things that happen on the other side of this. It's tough and it never gets any easier.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that I've been really blown away by is the amount of people who reach out to me on social media asking me advice. Mm-hmm. How did you get sober? What did you do? And I walk them through the most arbitrary parts of it. And I get some really touching responses from people who are like, you know, my boyfriend was on the verge of death and he reached out to you and he's a year sober now and you changed his life. And it's like, that makes all of this worthwhile. It makes all of the suffering that I went through actually amount to something because I know that I'm helping people.
Where you come in, your sphere of influence, you know, and you being outward about your recovery and just, I mean, you are plugged in into a lot of areas in your life that do draw in controversy or there's a stigma around it. I can imagine what your DMs look like. And, you know, like that is the big question, you know, focusing on sobriety because of the industry that you're in, what you've seen, what you're involved in. How did you take the brick off the pedal?
Some brilliant person thought it was a good idea in 2005 to bumper South by Southwest directly up to Winter Music Conference. So I spent 5 days in Austin uh-huh. and flew from Austin to South Beach for 7 days of Winter Music Conference. Uh-huh. And for 12 days and nights, I was drinking gin and I was high on cocaine for 12 days. And when all of these great parties went on that year, I met all these great people. There's like pictures of like me and like Kelly Osbourne. I have no recollection of any of this because it was like literally like a 12-day blackout.
Right.
You know, I probably ate next to nothing. I probably didn't have a glass of water for 12 days.
Let alone sleep, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, who sleeps?
Right.
And that was just murder on my body. I mean, luckily, I was in my early 30s at the time. So, I mean, like, I could endure such abuse. I went through all of that. And I came home. And I think I spent the greater part of that week in bed. I believe I flew out on the Saturday to play in Lima, Peru. The promoters that used to bring me there, when I would get in the car, they would throw like a bag of cocaine that was the size of like home base into my lap. And, you know, South America, it's pure cocaine. Like it's not New York City stepped up.
Right. No, it's the good stuff. Crazy. Yeah.
It's real coke. And I was going to stay an extra day on this trip. So I really wanted to see Lima. I love ceviche. I really wanted to like dig into the culture. And I woke up the next morning having done all of that cocaine. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I did not like what I saw. It was terrifying. I was like, I look 20 years older than I am.
Yeah.
Looked like absolute shit. And it scared me to death. And I said to myself in that moment, this has to stop. And the main reason that I had to do the clean sweep was because, as we all know, you know, no one's ever sitting around their house at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a sunny day with their buddies and said, hey, you know what we should do? Let's get some coke. Like, it's always alcohol that rules, you know, you're out and you want to stay out and you're tired. And it's like, okay, got to keep going. And so the only way to shut down all of it was to just yank the whole thing out by the root. Only way to do it. Like, right. I had to like wipe it out of my life. My DJ rider before I was sober was a very complicated myriad of different bottles of liquor. But I always asked them to bring Bombay Sapphire in a champagne bucket. And in the first 15, 20 minutes of my set, I would drink that bottle of Sapphire like a Gatorade, straight out of the bottle.
Wow, Tommy.
And, you know, that is an unsustainable.
Right.
I mean, mind you, I was DJing every weekend. So that was 52 weekends a year.
Yeah.
Of that. That's a one-way ticket to cirrhosis. Like, if there's, you know, if there has ever been one, but like, I lack the ability to like shut it down. I was never able to like have any concept of like, you know what? I have a big day tomorrow. I should like, I should go home.
No off button. No,
there was none of that ever. I mean, the reason I got my name was because I would always be on the dance floor when the sun came up. And one morning, doing a very long and complicated math problem of psychedelics, somebody came up to me and said, "Good morning, sunshine." And it was like, ping. And I was like, that's it.
That's amazing.
I'm Tommy Sunshine. Like, and it was like,
yes.
In that moment, the persona and the artist in that realm was born.
It was born, yes.
But it came from the fact that I would show up at 10 o'clock when the doors opened and they would have to like candy crane me off the dance floor, like so that the guys could sweep up. Like it was like, I never wanted to leave the rave. So, and you know, that permeated into like the rest of my life, you know, like,
yeah.
I mean, I suppose I was a high functioning drug addict, but I'm not so sure, because I mean, who has the bandwidth to like take 2 days of their life off? Also, that environment fostered, I mean, it was like a
exactly.
You know, it's like, oh, we're going to give you like all of this time to yourself. What do you do with it? It was like, well, we're going to party like I'm in Van Halen. That's what we're going to do.
Yeah. So, just make sure you show up at your gig. You're good.
Sometimes, not always. Until I was sober, I either missed the flight in or the flight home of every single gig. And, you know, I'd fly into town to play in Houston or whatever. And, you know, I was supposed to fly home on Sunday morning, and I'd fly home on like Tuesday. The party's 1,000 people. The after party's 400. Then 100 people go to someone's house. Then another 50 go to another house. And I would be like with the three last people standing on Tuesday and be like, yeah, I should probably fly home. And like, it was like that every single weekend. And I don't say this, I want to make sure that it's clear that when I talk about it, if you take it at face value and you listen to it as somebody who has boundaries and has limits and does not have the disease of alcoholism or drug addiction, that might sound like a good time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What I have to make abundantly clear is that the entire time all of this was happening, even as good of a time as it could ever be, I was suffering. And underneath all of that was an immense amount of pain. And I want to make sure that's clear. It's not bragging rights. It's like, you know, and I can laugh about it. It's silly. You know, I look back at it. A lot of people question my sense of humor because, you know, I'll put up memes on my Instagram and stuff that are like drug memes and stuff, but they're funny. I mean, yes, I'm sober, but, you know, you don't have to trade your sense of humor for sobriety.
This is right. You know what I mean? Yes, yes.
Like, you can still have a good laugh.
You still got to laugh about life in general. Yeah.
It's the absurdity of it all. You know what I mean? And it's like, you know, I'm laughing for the same reason as somebody who's still in the full thralls of partying. We're laughing about the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it just so happens that I don't do that anymore. That's it. I'm very lucky to be alive. I know that there was no chance that I would have made it to 2010 for like the initial rush of EDM. There's no way I would have lived that long if I had continued to party.
Mm-hmm.
And the really scary thing is that I think that if I had, for some reason, survived to that moment, I think I would have took more than a few people down with me, because I would have been a very, very terrible influence on a lot of young
people. Right, yeah.
And, you know, that is something that I can be grateful for.
Tommy, let me ask you this. So I know that, you know, you've taken us through your journey as far as what the party life looked like when the brick was on the pedal. And for a lot of us, you know, when we are looking at sobriety and, you know, especially in these creative environments, it's a very big decision because there's culture created around it. And sometimes some of us may even experience friction with the work that we do because we decided to get sober. I guess my question is, you touched on the fact that you were experiencing pain while in active addiction. What was that pain for you?
I didn't really know who I was. I was very self-conscious. Drugs and alcohol were a social lubricant. They helped me, you know, get over my stage fright, and I was able to get up in front of people and be very bold and commanding. And, you know, I'm a survivor of abuse as a child. So, I mean, like, that was definitely a big part of it. And there was a lot of self-medicating going on.
Yeah.
And, you know, as an adult, I'm on antidepressants, I'm on ADHD medication, like all of that was untreated So I was just like through the streets with like, I had no idea, because, you know, in the 90s.
Nobody was talking about it. Yeah. Well, no. What is that? Yes.
My life and my mood was so unpredictable that if I went out and drank myself half to death, I knew the next day exactly how I was going to feel. And even if that was terrible, at least I knew how I was going to feel and I could count on it. In that way, I could control it. I mean, obviously that's absurd if you look at it logically, but like, in lieu of offering myself up to the altar of everyday life and waking up one day and being happy and having a great time, and then the next day, for absolutely no logical reason, be totally depressed, I learned to control that via substance abuse. I mean, I was resistant to get on any sort of prescription drugs. And during the pandemic, my anxiety got to a point where it was just completely unbearable. Every night at 7 o'clock, I felt like there was an elephant sitting on my chest. Yeah. And I just couldn't deal with it anymore. And I went to my doctor and we tried to dial it in the best that we could. It's changed my life. There was a time in the not so distant past that mental health was like, it was the punchline to jokes.
Yeah, you're just crazy, period.
Nobody was like going like, well, you know, actually, I kind of have a tough time of this too. We should talk about it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, at least there's discussion.
Yeah, there's conversation, there's research, there's awareness around it now that we didn't experience growing up and especially in the scene. And for someone myself, I self-medicated a lot, trying to just navigate the moods and the depression and anxiety. And yeah, it's just amazing what opens up when I removed the substance. Like, I'm more aware of when those mood swings occur or what I can do proactively to prevent that. Like you touched on it, there's a spectrum of where someone exists with that. And that spectrum also is relayed over to sobriety. You know, there's a whole movement of being completely sober. And then there's the other side of the spectrum of sober curious. And so there's different types of conversations that are happening because of that. And again, it's just that full awareness there. And I don't know, Tommy, like, I follow you on social media and you seem like a woke fella. Like, the topics that you touch on, again, you like at the beginning of our conversation, it creates a lot of dynamics from all sides on the topics that you put out there and use your platform to have a voice. And, you know, that ties into what we're doing with this podcast. Like, how do you know to use your voice or shift your voice to just the music or shift it to activism or your sobriety? Or is that all meshed in and it's just packaged as Tommy Sunshine? Like, how do you balance all of that?
Being in dance music and being a raver is who I am. Being an activist is also who I am. And in equal amounts, people have said to me like, well, why don't you just have a separate Instagram for political stuff? And, and I'm like, well, yeah, it's called SoundCloud. Like, if you don't want to know what I have to say and you don't want to know me as a person, then follow my SoundCloud and you'll get pinged when I put out new music and won't be bothered by my perspective. Like, you're not forced to be here. Like, it's like you followed me. Like, it's like I didn't like trap you here. Like, if you don't like what I have to say, get out. Like, I'm fine with that. You know what I mean? Like, and if I think back to all of the musicians who had an impact on me, like in my life, from John Lennon to Bob Marley to Kurt Cobain, you know, down the run, all of these people their lives were entrenched in activism. It's incredible to me that it's taken as long as it has for these things to become normalized. You know, people who say that they don't pay attention to politics, that is some deeply entrenched privilege to be able to say that you don't care about politics. Because let me tell you something. Anyone who isn't white, politics affects quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm so active is because I know that none of these things are going to affect me. I am a straight white man. None of this stuff is going to affect me. But I know to the degree that it affects everybody else. Mm-hmm. And that's why I fight. It's why I show up to LGBTQ causes. It's why I show up for DACA protests. It's why I show up for the Dakota Access Pipeline and Indigenous rights. It's why I show up for, you know, all of my views on the police. And I know that I can make a difference. I have, without going into particulars, I have lost gigs because of sponsors who did not like my
brain. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I've been pushed aside and you know, overlooked for different things because whoever the main sponsor was, you know, took one look at my Instagram, and as they are actively in the middle of a unionizing scandal, their workers want to unionize, and they see that I'm pro-union, and they're like, "Get him out of here!"
Right. Right. Have you seen that being outward about your sobriety as well? Has that affected anything?
Well, I mean, you know, and we should definitely talk about this because this is very important. Like, one of the things that, and this is by no means a deterrent, but when you make the decision that you want to be sober, you have to be prepared to lose a lot of the things in your life. Because, you know, I can say from my own experience, I lost almost every friend I had in New York, all of the people that I went out with all the time. Because what happened was I continued to want to go out. I never stopped going out. I knew that I could continue to be in the scene and contribute in the ways that I do sober. But I made a lot of people uncomfortable. Right. Because while they were in the throes of drinking and doing drugs, they would look at me and it would make them question their own choices. And the logical response to that was not to call Tommy next time. Because then they wouldn't have to feel that way. Yeah. So I got pushed out of all of the friend circles I was in, and I lost almost every promoter that I played for in the Midwest, in the whole of the country, because the promoters that booked me knew I was a party guy. So like when they were calling up my booking agent to book me, they weren't just booking me to play the club. They knew that the minute I got off the plane, we were going to go to a strip club and it was going to turn into this whole thing. And they were buying into this bigger kind of thing. I had to like completely reestablish myself. Because all of the people that I played for left me in the dust. Anyone who's listening to this, if you have a friendship that could be compromised by whether or not you drink or do drugs, that is not a friendship. That is not a real relationship. If that exits your life, it's a blessing. Like that is not somebody who really cares about you, and that is not somebody who really cares about your well-being.
Yeah, it's like when you're in active addiction, you find your people. And so it's about surrounding you with folks who enable you and support you in addiction. And when that goes away, there isn't that bond there that was created on using or drinking anymore.
until I was sober, I can pretty confidently say that every single person that I dated in my entire life was crazier than I was and had a worse drug problem than I did. Because I could then look at them and be like, well, at least I'm not them. Like I was able to have this comparison. So, you know, like at least I'm one rung down from whatever that is. I mean, it's terrible that that's the way I looked at it, but I'm being honest.
Yeah, it's honest. Yeah.
And trust me, I didn't know I was doing that at the time.
Right.
I know this now looking back with hindsight. I mean, it's terrible to think that that was like how I went through 33 years of my life, but it was.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know until you get on the other side. You're like, oh my, that's like it's your default. And I'm sure your partner now, your relationship now is different from what it was.
I've been with my wife, Daniela, for going on, it's going to be 16 years this year.
Congratulations, Tommy. It's incredible.
She's never seen me like that.
Wow.
So these like old pictures and I have a martini in one hand and a cigarette in the other. She's like, I don't know who that person is. I never got to know that person, you know, like, and I was a different person for a real long time. I think one of the driving factors for me that has kept me sober is that I would never, ever want to put her through the hell of having to pick up the pieces of me falling from grace. I could never do that to somebody that I really love. I have to say how much I admire this moment and how many resources are available to people, how candid people are in talking about their stories. And I think we're only going to get more.
Yeah.
Like, I don't see this going the other way.
I only hope. Yes, absolutely. You know, just keep pushing forward and be an example. And even if it's in the smallest way, it helps one person. It's all worth it.
If I can just say something, I think that the reason that my activism is so stitched into my life and how much it means to me is because my activism is not unlike my sobriety, which is not unlike my place in the music business. And I can explain this. We are living in a time where it is abundantly clear that our government does not care about its people. That is abundantly clear. I don't care like what side of the whatever you're on and whatever imaginary team you think you're a part of. They are one team and we are their opposition. And if you are not a wealthy person in this country, the government does not care about you. So what do you do with that information? The only way forward for us as a people is mutual aid. That is how we move forward. So knowing that they're not going to take care of us, we need to take care of each other.
Yes.
So if that means, you know, my wife and I go to Washington Square Park and we do mutual aid on Fridays where we give away food and PPE and clothes and, you know, make sure that all of the unhoused people are fed and they have warm, that they're warm and that they have the tools to help them survive. Mm-hmm. And this is not dissimilar to what I do for people who reach out to me who want to get sober. And, you know, I have a record label that is almost entirely based around new talent and emerging artists and helping those people break through and pulling them up and get them to like skip rungs on the ladder so that they can get into the music business. It's all one thing. this is all one thing. There is no separate anything to me. This all lands on the same place.
Yes.
It's all about us making a decision to help each other. And that's the most important thing that any of us can realize right now. And I think it's the golden message that we've been shown since, you know, this pandemic.
Yes, absolutely.
We have to become personally responsible mm-hmm. for the things that we do ourselves. And then we have to do everything that we can to help everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's it. I mean, all of this stuff is not super complicated. It's very easy to get tangled up in things and get pulled in the wrong direction. But once you take the time to center yourself and to put your feet on the ground and realize the gravity of the world around you, you see clearly and you know that the only way forward for us is to help each other.
Yep, together.
That's it. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's everything. You could ask me a question about any of the things, even my teaching at NYU revolves around mentorship. I sit with seniors who are about to graduate mm-hmm. and, you know, they play me their music and I give them, you know, critiques and objectively what they could do better. And we talk about the music business and we talk about what their expectations are. Mm-hmm. And I try to help them be realistic about like what they're about to embark on and how hard it is and how much they're going to have to work. And, you know, I'm helping these kids. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, it's just so wild because it's like these forums are very different. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. playing a late night set on New Year's Eve from 5 a.m. till 7:30 a.m. is quite different than going to NYU and teaching.
I know, Tommy, it's incredible.
It's the same thing. Like it really is the same thing. Like, and I love that. Like I love that people can look at me from a crowd and see someone who A, is 50, B, who is sober, and C, who is a dancing fool while playing records because he absolutely loves what he does. It's just pure joy.
Joy, yes.
And I'm trying to project that as much as I can because boy, do we need that right now.
Mm-hmm.
We are in a drought of joy, for mm-hmm. sure. And anything that any of us can do to make anyone else happy is a step in the right direction.
Yes, so, please.
This is what it is. It's just like, you know, let's have a good time. Let's laugh and let's help each other.
Love it, Tommy. Oh my goodness. I just thank you. Thank you for that wrap up of who you are and what you do. It beautifully said, and it comes from a pure place of intention. You know, there isn't malice behind it. It's that unity consciousness.
We all win from
it. Yeah, we all win. We all win. And I love it.
Anyone who's listening to this who isn't already sober, I want you to hear these words. Getting sober is not easy, but it is possible. And I assure you that your life on the other side of whatever it is that you're going through will be better. You can count on it.
Thank you so much, Tommy. I was just going to say, do you have any closing words or advice for any of our listeners? Because we do have newly sober creatives coming in, or, you know, folks who are asking questions about it. And so nicely put.
I've never heard sober curious before. And I absolutely love that.
Yes. yes. Check it out. It's a whole hashtag and all.
Great. I mean, like, It's nice that things can be a little looser because, you know, as you know, getting sober was a little dreary. You know, it was such a thing. And it was like, oh, do I really want to like get involved in all of this? Like,
yeah. Or even say that I am. Do I want to take on that label?
I have said that loud and proud for as long as I have been sober. And it gets mixed reactions. You kind of win because you can really sort out the good from the bad, because right away, if people have a problem with that, like, you don't even want to waste your time trying to cultivate a relationship with people because
sometimes they're just not ready to hear it.
Sobriety is only possible if you want to be sober.
Mm-hmm.
At no point before that moment will any of anything work. There is no amount of people that could wish you to be sober. There is no program you could be dragged through. Nothing. If you don't want it, it will not happen. You have to make the decision to open yourself up to the idea of putting that part of your life behind you. So make the decision and do it, because I am living proof that an addict and an alcoholic can persevere and go on to have an incredible career, fall in love, get married, become a teacher, and love the rest of their life. Wasn't easy. It's definitely not easy. You have to want to put in the work.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it is worth every toil and trouble that you could ever have to endure, because the other side of this is paradise.
Oh, beautiful, Tommy. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your story. And with those closing words, how can our listeners find you or follow you?
Oh, you can find me on all the social media thingies. TOMMIE Sunshine. Like, I'm very present. Not Facebook so much. I don't like Facebook. But like on all the other stuff, I'm easy to find and easy to reach. So if anyone has any questions or wants to talk, or I'm very available.
Wonderful, Tommy. Thank you so much.
Peace and love.
I'm so grateful for the time I had to speak with Tommy. I learned a lot through his shared experience. He was even kind enough to bonus our time with more conversation after our recording. As promised, here is Tommy Sunshine and Breakthrough with their track Untouchable, featuring Caitlin Victoria.
like to be romancing. Hey, hey, 'cause I know that you found me. I wish that you could see what I see. You are something true and original. So different in a way that I can't ignore. You make me wanna touch the untouchable. You make me wanna touch the untouchable. You are something true.
If you like what you heard in this episode, please rate and review. Your feedback makes a difference and helps us connect with others who are finding strength in our stories. Also, be sure to subscribe or follow where you are listening to this podcast. You can follow us on social media on Instagram at The Creative Sober. Thank you for listening to The Creative Sober Podcast. I am your host, Missing May. Until next time, stay healthy, stay creative.